Welcome back, everybody. This is Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. On our way to our conversation, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. We saw that we now have had 228 homicides in Baltimore City this year so far, far outpacing last year's numbers for the whole year. But beyond that's also all the shootings we're seeing, people being shot, people witnessing and seeing shooting, family members whose fathers, mothers, sons, daughters, grandparents are victims of shooting or of murder in this city, what effect that has on people. And we've been seeing in the articles, one after another one I read this morning, where both Congressman Elijah Cummings and Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake said the community has to step up. And some people would argue the community is already stepping up. And if you mean by stepping up, they should be talking to the police. Well, we'll talk about that as well, what that means. We're joined here today by Son of Nun, hip-hop artist and activist from the new radical music label Firebrand Records. Son of Nun, good to have you back. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Dr. Phil Leaf is with us. Phil Leaf, of course, professor and director of the Center for Prevention of Youth Violence at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Phil, good to have you in the studio.
Good to be back.
J.T. Timpson's with us, who is site director for the Park Heights Safe Streets. Good to have you here again, J.T.
Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Maricela Gomez, a physician, community activist, author of the book Race, Class, Power, and Organizing in East Baltimore, Rebuilding Abandoned Communities in America, and also is now a blogger at Huffington Post. And Maricela, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark.
And y'all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org, log on to our Facebook pages, tweet me at Mark Steiner, but do call in 410-319-8888. And I really do want to kind of begin with, I mean, of course, whenever you see that a 90-year-old woman sitting on her stoop is hit by a bullet, what grazed her, and she was funny about it, saying it was her cold cream on her hand that let the bullet just graze and bounce off. But she clearly was deeply affected by this. You can tell by the other things she said about witnessing a murder for the first time of her life and seeing a young man die, another man shot, a 10-year-old boy is shot, the mayor and the Elijah Cummings calling for the people to step up and say who did it. But underneath of all this is the effect on the people who live in those communities and on the people we're talking about here. They become stories and names in a paragraph. And it's good for the Sun to have put those names of people who were murdered in the paper and who they were. That's important. But what's the effect on community? Because most of these murders, you look at the map, are happening in Son of Nun, are happening in specific communities in the city. They're not all over the city. They're concentrated in the poorest, blackest neighborhoods in Baltimore. Son of Nun?
Oh, yeah, very true. I mean, the first thing I want to start out by saying is, you know, you see the news media picking this stuff up, and they're like, you know, my God, these levels of violence are out of control. And it's like as if the ones last year, the year before, were not out of control, you know, in terms of the effect on the community. It's the same impact that they've been having all along, you know, and the roots of these issues are the same, you know, in terms of the history of economic devastation, the redlining, all of those things. So we're talking about increased levels of violence on communities that have already been devastated by violence in so many other forms, right? There's the physical, there's the issues with housing and education, disparate health care. You know, like those are impacts that are devastating the community too. So I feel like whatever the solution is, it has to have all of those prongs.
I mean, I think when we talk about approaching this violence, Phil Leaf, that's what we never talk about. The psychological effect, the emotional effect, the effect on human beings in these communities.
Well, I think it's both the psychological effect and it's the assets. We're losing people in these neighborhoods. And after three generations, we're losing generations of people. So we have fewer elders out there. We have fewer people who want to stay in some of these neighborhoods, not that they move out of Baltimore, but they may want to move into a different neighborhood. So both the personal relationships and the assets become very fragile. And we know, particularly from children, that this exposure to these things have an impact when it's violence. But now we really need to be shifting our conception of this, because it's not just the individual shooting or the murder today. We've had three generations and 30 years in Baltimore City. And we need, again, I just want to also emphasize that people in these neighborhoods are responding to doing these things. I can't imagine how I would live. I don't have the capacities to do this. The strength of many of these people to get through the days, but how do we create schools that are really supportive of the young folks when, in any classroom, one of the children may have had something happen on their block, not every day, every block. But in some of these schools, if you have 25, 30 schools, something happened to at least one or two of your students. How do we, can we really assume they just come in and, oh, now I'm in the school, I can sort of get my act together? No, we really need support of these things. And again, these are things the neighborhood folks are doing. I think one of the things that the positive thing that happened as a result of the uprising is that a lot of institutions started talking about, we need to help. We need to be doing something, whether I'm an employer or somebody working in the school or I'm a grandmother. There's something I could be doing, and they are doing these things. But how do we support these efforts? And how do we, again, as you were saying, focus our efforts in the neighborhoods where this is, this is an ongoing problem, challenge?
TJ, go ahead. Then we'll turn to Marcella.
it definitely does have that effect on the particular neighborhoods. In Safe Streets, we see it every day with the guys that we deal with. And it's truly become a way of life, pretty much. And it's unfortunate to see how the little kids, the youngsters in the neighborhood, catch on to the way that they see things happening every day, and it becomes normal, which is why we view it from the health approach, that the violence is contagious and that we must find a way to prevent the spread of this violence. And the way we do that is we try to interrupt the transmission of it and change those behavioral norms to try to get people to understand that violence is not normal. The way that you respond to a particular beef in the neighborhood, responding to it by shooting someone or killing somebody is not normal. A 90-year-old woman sitting on a stoop should not have to worry about getting hit by a bullet, by a stray bullet. So we really try to, because it does, it has a real deep effect on the neighborhoods and has effect on the people in the neighborhoods. And we try to even re-engage the elders in the neighborhood to make them feel safe with coming back out, sitting on their porches, sitting on their stoops. But when things like this happen, it takes us back 10 steps. So it's definitely something that we really, really have to find a way to continue to work on and try to figure out how we can solve this problem.
Marcel, as someone who's kind of research this intensely. I'm really do want to focus here again on the psychological effect on the psyche of a community. Marcella?
Yes. I'm listening to my co-panelists and recognizing how important everything that is being said is, and then how we bring it all together. So, a lot of what my research and my activism in the community has noted is that our communities are fragmented. And so this perpetual violence, which isn't just this generation, but just a violence, a structural violence, a social violence, a political violence, and now we're seeing more of a physical violence in the form of brutality, not only by guns in the hands of police, but guns and other types of weapons in the hands of community members. So this community fragmentation is a big part of what doesn't allow the community to be able to come together and build a network that can start to address some of the issues in the community. Some recent interviews I did during the uprising before and after, residents were very clear, not only the elders, but the young ones too, saying, I think several quotes from folks was, I don't get involved, I keep to myself. I keep my block clean and I go back inside. And if I see folks standing on the corner, I go the opposite way, because even if they're just standing there talking, if I associate with them, I'll be perceived as having being up to trouble or dealing drugs or getting involved with gangs. So I don't associate, young black men talking about just standing on the corner waiting for food outside the Chinese carryout, being pulled up by the cops and being harassed, made to sit on the sidewalk and asked for IDs. So we have this chronic separation within communities that makes it very difficult for communities to grow from inside. This fragmentation causes stress in the community. We have a hypothesis. Geronimus out in the Midwest talks about the weathering effect. This is when communities, but then she studied in depth black communities, low-income communities, that continuously go through stress, live in stressful situations like the neighborhoods of Middle East and West Baltimore that we're talking about, how that chronically affects their health status. We know this is true. We're seeing huge disparities in health between African-American populations and white populations and other oppressed populations. So we have a chronic psychological, mental health, physical health effect from a perpetual violence in our communities, not just the recent violence of killings and activities that now has become more glamorized, if you will, but just the chronic way that our communities have been segregated and separated. When you have elders and young people like saying, don't blame it on the shootings. Don't blame it on the uprising. We've been fragmented already. This is just making it worse. They say, don't blame it on the. It's not just about the police. We are communities that have been left alone, have been disregarded, have been disinvested. So we are communities that have been fragmented from the whole of society. And what happens when you do that to a group of people, a community, is we're reaping what we've been sowing in America for the good past 300 years. And I think part of what the conversation, as we continue to have it, is to look at the chronic way the disinvestment that has occurred, that has resulted in the social conditions that we're dealing with now. And I do hope we talk a bit about the alternative economics that we need to think about if we're ever going to look at the drug trade and trying to address why people turn to dealing drugs as a way to make a living.
I do want to get to that. I'm going to get to the phones here now, but I want to come back to the things you said and we've all said. I think that the alternative economics, the question of the effect, as Philippe was talking about, on young people and children in this community, what happens to them in our schools. And I think that it's clear from the statements of our political leaders that they have no understanding of any of this in terms of how to put their hands around it, because there's a complexity. It's easy to say more police. It's easy to say, citizens, you need to stand up, but not really understanding the kind of depth of what we're facing and how we need to advise them and push them on what they need to do. 410-319-8888. Let's go to the phone. Please join us with your ideas and thoughts, because we have to put our arms around this. Dwayne, line 3, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, this is Shorty. How y'all doing? I'm glad y'all having this conversation. It's long overdue.
Go ahead, Shorty.
I'm glad y'all having this conversation. This has been set in place, like the lady said, for generations, and it's not going to be done overnight, but we need to place a foundation in which to start. We need to start some conversations, and we need to engage the community, and this is directly affecting. We can't talk about them. We have to talk to them, and we have to talk with them to make that change. That's about what I got to say.
Shorty, thanks. Always good to hear from you. And I do want to, and folks, I really want to hear ideas at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. I mean, I think that, like all of us, you read these articles every day in The Sun or The Brew or The Afro, wherever you happen to be reading. You listen to news broadcasts all the time. But we're not getting to the heart of this. And to me, the heart of it is something stuff that you were talking about, Phil, which has to do with the effect it's having on young people and families. Whenever somebody goes to a school, many of us have had this experience, and you sit and talk to young people in a school and you say, how many people in this classroom know someone who's been shot or killed? 90% of the hands go up in most of the schools that are in the inner city in this city. And what that does to a child. when we used to do this program around violence back in the 90s in the city, and we were also covering the same time the battles in Northern Ireland, there were more people killed in the streets of Baltimore than in all the violence in Northern Ireland.
But there's also, you know, when you go into the, quote, war zones, there's also support systems that those communities
yes.
develop, because they recognize that there's a violence. They recognize that not just the children, but everybody in that neighborhood, literally, particularly for children, their brains function differently after with this exposure to violence over time. And so part of it is how you create, and many times we talk about these war zones where they are neighborhoods and communities that have real relationships. They're in fighting with each other, but it's not as fragmented. And I think one of the things that Maricela said that needs to also be, because again, there's multiple levels we need to be dealing with this. Part of it is at individuals. How do they get supported? Particularly those people who are trying to support the neighborhoods and the communities, because you find whether it's the block moms or the other folks or people working on the safe street programs, they burn out. I mean, because they're in the middle of this stuff, and we need to
right.
recognize they need supports. But as Maricela is saying, we've got structures, policies, and practices that have been going on for generations, if not for hundreds of years. And so in Baltimore City, if you're living in a community that has a second, if not very long commuting, where the jobs aren't here anymore, and people are going to have to get up early in the morning even if they have a job, that means we need to have support. You know, that means a parent who's trying to get some funding for their family isn't going to be in the neighborhood. They're not even going to be in Baltimore City, because that's not where the jobs are. That means we as a community, that's where the after-school programs need to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not thinking about just the school after-school programs, the faith community, the neighborhood, the block moms. I mean, one of the tragedies is that over the last 30 years, a lot of not necessarily affluent people, but people who are living in these neighborhoods have gotten stretched even thinner because of the finances and other things and the difficulties of just earning a living. Or if they're in a neighborhood that's sort of turning around, all of a sudden their rent's higher, their taxes are higher. So even the money that they have goes less far. And so, you know, I think recognizing that there are structures, policies, and practices that really are, you know, sort of continuing these things, but also we have successes. You know, how can we get behind the successes? I, you know, call out to your show all the time saying, you know, that you have sort of the town hall on the air, and this radio station has the town hall on the air, and how those successes, you know, not the academics talking about them, but they themselves, like some of the people we have on today, and certainly Sean and other people have, you know, talking about how they're doing this, and hopefully other folks say, well, you know, I could be doing that. And then, but how do we support those things? How do we get the faith communities to support each other? How do we get, people on those blocks to recognize that if you just looked after some of the friends of your child or some of the friends of your grandchildren, that has a really important positive impact. It's not enough to only do that, but it's a necessary thing in that we have, you know, these very sparse communities where less assets, less opportunities in terms of options, and some of the options are even limited information because you don't have the people in those neighborhoods. They're dead now, or they're in jail, or they've moved away to really be able to deal with some of the dispute resolutions. And that's again what some of the Safe Street folks do. It's sort of both modeling, but it's also showing that some of these disputes can be resolved and prevented, and then people say, well, you know, maybe I can step in a little bit earlier, or maybe I could call them.
So what you're saying, in many ways, Phil, and what Maricela was saying earlier is the idea, and all of you have been saying, that the only way for us to begin to address this, get people in political power to address this, is to understand it's beyond just trying to stop the violence and arresting people and putting police in neighborhoods. I mean, that and it's a much more fundamental question.
But even the way you describe it, I mean, I think, and I don't want, you know, you're,
go ahead,
you're
man.
One of my... 30 years ago, we could talk about this as being a political issue. There's a lot of federal funding out there. There was a lot of, you know, research.
Right.
I think this is really a community issue of how do we mobilize ourselves? How do we mobilize our resources and assets? The city government, the state government can get really far behind this. doesn't matter. They don't have the resources. They don't have the tax base. I mean, you know, we can talk about how they got here, but that's a different issue. Where the assets are in are the individuals, the young people themselves, and what they're doing to have more positive relationships and do, you know, to trying to look after their younger siblings and other things. The people in the neighborhood who are really taking this on. Some of the faith leaders who are taking this on, but also some of the employers who are now hiring ex-offenders, saying, you know, if I'm an employer in Baltimore City, and I'm not hiring ex-offenders, I'm not hiring males from Baltimore City. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're not sort of saying, you know, that they're only felons. That almost and all of them have some sort of police record if they've been living here long enough. Just because, as you said, they get stopped and taken in. Now, it may not be a serious charge, but you know, these multiple charges. And so, again, I think it's more refocusing our efforts. And, you know, obviously the government has a role to play, but I think that after 30 or 40 or 300 years, you know, it's going to be us in the community, us in the neighborhood, working with each other and developing the relationships. And because when I say it's us, I'm not thinking it's the academic institutions leading the way, but certainly we're employers, and some of us have some expertise and knowledge that we can be sharing, not directing, but sharing with others.
So now let me bring you back in here as somebody who's involved in both the cultural and political and community life. How you respond to things you've just heard?
I mean, I think that there is a role, obviously, for the community to play, but I think that it can't be said enough that there's a much larger role that the federal government and the city government needs to be responsible for, only because, let's just look at some of the history, right? You look at the Great Depression, you know, like nobody had much money, but the federal government spent itself into a deficit in order to put people to work, in order to address some of the problems, you know, and I feel like something like that should be done for the city so that people could be put to work.